Welcome to the Brownstein Hyatt Farber Schreck podcast series. Well-meaning businesses that utilize independent contractors face a host of challenges in today's evolving legal landscape. Join Brownstein employment shareholders Kayla Dreyer and Luke Glisson and associate Russell Calvillage for a fresh look at employee classification and learn the risks of misclassification in an increasingly hostile environment. This discussion provides employers, HR professionals, and in-house counsel with the knowledge they need to accurately classify independent contractors.
Good afternoon, everyone. We are so thrilled that you decided to spend your lunch hour with us today to talk about a very important topic in employment law, which is independent contractor classification. My name is Kayla Dreyer. I'm a shareholder at Brownstein. I'm an employment lawyer. I specialize in restricted covenant disputes and do a whole other host of other things in the employment arena. With me, I have my fellow shareholder, Luke Glisson.
Thanks, Kayla. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We're thrilled to have you. I've been an employment lawyer for over 15 years now, and I handle all aspects of advice and counseling for employers. I do not handle litigation. I leave that to my colleagues here, but otherwise I've advised employers on a wide range of issues.
My name is Russell Calvillage. I'm an associate attorney here at Brownstein. I do a lot of work with Ms. Dreyer, Mr. Glisson, and I do employment litigation and advice to counsel.
We have a lot of folks who are in-house here today, and we're hoping to provide you with a very value-driven presentation today. But we do have a roadmap of topics we want to cover, but this is meant to be a conversation. So if you have any questions that you would like addressed, please feel free to put them in the chat. So with that, this afternoon, we're going to be talking about a background of all of the numerous tests that are being employed by federal agencies, state agencies, and at the local level to determine whether a worker is properly classified as an independent contractor or an employee. We're going to be talking about the consequences of misclassifying workers as independent contractors as opposed to W-2 employees. We're also going to take a segue to that very exciting topic of restrictive covenants and independent contractors. Obviously, that's a very hot topic in employment law right now. So we do want to address that because you do see restrictive covenant issues coming up in the independent contractor sphere. And then we're going to round out our presentation with a discussion of how worker misclassification can impact M&A deals and considerations that a business should be thinking of very carefully whenever they think a reclassification might be in order. Luke, would you please tell us a brief background of the history of the U.S. Department of Labor's worker classification analysis and tests?
So it dates back decades. And since the 1940s, the Department of Labor and courts have applied an economic reality test. That's the term that we hear over and over again to determine whether a worker is either an employee or an independent contractor. And the ultimate inquiry is whether, as a matter of economic reality, the worker is economically dependent on the employer for work or on the business for work, and thus would be an employee, or is in business for him or herself, and thus is an independent contractor. In assessing economic dependence, courts in the Department of Labor have historically conducted a totality of the circumstances analysis. So they try to look at the full picture of the relationship. They consider multiple factors to determine whether a worker is an employee or an independent contractor. And traditionally, there has been no single factor that has a predetermined weight or is assigned more weight than any others. However, in January 2021, the Department of Labor published a rule, the official regulation, that provided guidance on the classification of independent contractors. And it identified a new set of factors, or realigned the set of factors to be considered, and focused on five economic reality factors to guide the inquiry. Two of those five factors One, the nature and degree of control over the work, and two, the worker's opportunity for profit or loss were designated as core factors that were the most probative and carried greater weight in the analysis. The first of those factors, nature and degree of control over the work, fairly obvious. And that's the most commonly thought of factor. You look at the relationship and things like, does the worker have to work from an assigned location? Are there strict policies and procedures that the worker has to follow to carry out their work? Are they reporting in on a regular basis to someone who oversees their work and the progress of their work? The more of those types of controls are in place, the more likely it is that the relationship is an employment relationship and the person is an employee. The second factor is a worker's opportunity for profit or loss. It's not as clear and not something that we typically think of as commonly as the first factor, but what it's really getting at is the worker operating independent from the business that it's providing services to? Whereas if an employee is paid a salary, regardless of the profits or losses of the business on a daily basis, an independent contractor is running its own business. So it has a direct hook into whether its business is making profits or losses, even on a daily basis. And it can choose to do things like invest in marketing for itself, invest in better technology for itself, and it's making those decisions independent of the business that it's providing services for. So the 2021 test focused in on those two factors, and it said if both of those factors point for the same classification, there's a substantial likelihood that the worker is classified based on that classification. Now, it also discussed three less probative or non-core factors. And those are the amount of skill required for the work, the degree of permanence of the working relationship, and whether the work is part of an integrated unit of production. I think the first two of the second set of factors are fairly clear. The last factor is whether the work is part of an integrated unit of production.
What does that mean exactly?
It's a good question. And it was a new concept. It was a spin on a longstanding concept, but a new concept introduced to this analysis. And what it focused on was, is the work something that's being brought in where it appears to be part of the business? So the more that the work is integrated into the business and it appears that the worker is part of the business and appears to be classified or acting similar to an employee, the more likely that person should be classified as an employee.
Okay.
And it's not just based on the work that the person is performing, it's based on how the business treats that person. Are they treating the person as an employee?
So like, for example, like a person who is told that they have to wear the business's uniform, would that be a fact that would be considered?
Yeah, a number of examples. Someone who has to attend trainings that are oriented at company employees, someone who attends outside of work events where they're really holding themselves out as being part of the company. However, the second group of three factors, while still taken into consideration, were not given as much weight as the first two factors. So it was unlikely that the last three factors, even if they pointed in the opposite direction of the first two factors, would result in a different classification of the worker. Now, the effective date of the 2021 rule was March 8, 2021, after the new administration took office. Immediately after taking office, the new administration issued a rule delaying the effective date to May. And then it went through an abbreviated rulemaking process to withdraw the 2021 rule. The business community was not happy with that. The 2021 rule had a positive impact in that it would narrow the scope of employees, broaden the scope of independent contractors. So the new administration's attempt to withdraw the rule was challenged in court. And a lawsuit was filed in federal district court in the Eastern District of Texas. And that court issued a decision that vacated the withdrawal of the rule. So despite the then current administration's attempt to withdraw the rule, the court said, no, you cannot do that. The previous rulemaking went through all the required steps and the rule will take effect. So what the Department of Labor has done is it's gone through a years-long process to rescind the 2021 rule and enact a new rule. And it's just done that. This year, the new rule took effect in March. And the Department of Labor explained its rationale that the 2021 rule would have been a confusing and disruptive effect on workers and businesses alike due to its departure from case law. Further, the department said that the rule was a departure from legal precedent, and it was not clear whether courts would adopt its analysis. So in an effort to go back, in effect, to the way things were before 2021, the new 2024 rule goes back to the totality of the circumstances approach. And an independent contractor refers to a worker who, as a matter of economic reality, is not economically dependent on an employer for work and is in business for themselves. The final rule provides six factors that should be considered. And there is no difference in the weight assigned to each of these factors. So to walk through these quickly, the first factor, opportunity for profit or loss. The second factor is investments by the worker and the potential employer. The third factor is the degree of permanence of the work relationship. The fourth factor is the nature and degree of control. Fifth factor is the extent to which the work performed is an integral part of the potential employer's business. And the sixth and final factor is skill and initiative. So you can see there's a different set of factors. There's a different weighting to the factors. And this new rule has taken factors from the 2021 rule and changed them. So for example, the fifth factor, the 2021 rule looked at whether the work was an integrated unit of the business. This test looks at whether the work performed is an integral part of the employer. So it's focused on the work being performed. Does that work support the core part of the potential employer's business? And if so, and it's more likely that the worker should be classified as an employee. Now, just as under the 2021 rule, and this is consistent with longstanding precedent, additional factors may be considered if they're relevant. And what this means is every situation is slightly different. There are many different types of roles that independent contractors perform, many types of businesses that they're supporting. So there's an opportunity here where if these factors don't summarize the relationship, you can bring additional factors in for consideration. And as we've discussed, there is a departure from the 2021 rule's core factors. The 2024 rule returns to the totality of the circumstances analysis.
And I think there might be a typo in this slide. It says economic realities. That should say totality of circumstances, right?
Well, you're considering all of the circumstances, but ultimately the inquiry is whether is the economic reality of the relationship that the worker is dependent on the business for work. And if so, they should be classified as an employee. If the economic reality is that the independent contractor is operating independently and they're not totally reliant on the business to support their livelihood, more likely that you can classify them as an independent contractor. So the two kind of work hand in hand, they're two concepts that are connected. Ultimately, looking at what's the economic, like regardless of how you write the independent contractor agreement, what's the reality of the relationship?
Got it. So form and function.
Exactly. Yeah. So the effect of this rule, talked through all the factors, we talked about how it's different than the 2021 rule. The effect will be to classify more workers as employees rather than independent contractors. No surprise. That's been an announced priority of this administration. How many workers will be reclassified? That's the big question. What we know is the rule is targeted toward workers in the gig economy, whose services support the central core function of the company that they're working for. That's what we have, things like drivers, delivery workers. It will have a broader impact than that, but we're still digesting the rule's impact to know how broad the impact is going to be.
So, Luke, we're getting a question from the audience. Someone's wondering if the Department of Labor's 2024 rule applies retroactively.
And that's something that we've talked about quite a bit leading up to the rule's effective date. And there's a few different ways to look at retroactivity under this rule. First way you can look at it is, do you have to apply this new six-factor test to relationships that you had entered into previously? And if you find that those workers were misclassified, you have to go back and treat them as if they were employees for wage purposes, for tax purposes, and for purposes of benefits. The answer to that question, we're comfortable, is no. There's not a retroactive requirement to undo everything that was done under the 2021 rule. It was validly enacted, upheld by in a court challenge, and was in effect until the new rule took effect this March. But from the effective date of the new rule going forward, there is now a different test in place, and you have to look at your independent contractors under the new test. And one final note, looking at independent contractors under the new test, if an employer comes to a conclusion that a worker is being misclassified and that under the new test, they're actually an employee, something that, and we may touch on this later as well, but something that the employer should do is look at its benefit plans and examine whether there's any retroactive requirement to provide a longer length of service under the benefit plans for that particular worker. There's a separate test involved in that issue, and it requires a separate analysis, but I think it's something that's important to flag, and I wanted to mention it here.
Well, thanks for that historic overview of the rule, Luke. There's a lot of considerations that employers need to take into account with regard to federal classification of independent contractors. Kayla, are there other considerations that an employer should take into account as well?
Absolutely. State and local. And before we jump into that, I do want to point out that there have been several challenges to the Department of Labor's new rule that were levied pretty quickly after this rule was about to become effective. The original Texas case that Luke referenced, that is still ongoing. It was remanded to, I think it's in the Eastern District of Texas. The plaintiffs in that case amended their complaint to challenge the rulemaking on the basis of a violation of the APA. You have a case out of Georgia, one out of Louisiana and Tennessee, similar types of arguments, non-delegation doctrine challenges obviously are very hot right now with this administration and its agencies rulemaking. The Congressional Review Act also might be at play potentially, but none of these cases successfully prevented the rule from taking effect. So they're still making their way through the courts, but employers are expected to comply with the rule on a go-forward basis. And also something to point out is the Department of Labor has rulemaking and enforcement authority over the FLSA. As most of the folks on this call know, there are a lot of different laws that apply to their employees. And so we're going to get into that now.
A few other tests to highlight, and there have been some recent changes to these tests as well. On June 13th, 2023, the National Labor Relations Board overruled its 2019 independent contractor standard that was focused on whether workers have entrepreneurial opportunity, and it returned to a common law multi-factor analysis. The impact of this rule change is it could lead to more workers were found to have been improperly classified. And if they are reclassified as employees under the NLRB rule, they would have rights to file a petition seeking representation by a union and would be covered by the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act. So for any employers dealing with organized labor or who have thought about the potential for a campaign by organized labor to organize their workforce, this might be relevant to you. Second, the IRS test. The IRS had long used a very thorough 20-factor analysis. That test took the broadest view of the relationship and really tried to draw in all parts of the engagement between a worker and a business. The IRS has now organized the test into three categories. It looks at behavioral control, financial control, and the relationship of the parties as compared to the Department of Labor's test. IRS is still taking a broader view of the relationship, and obviously classification under the IRS rule impacts employer taxes and wage withholdings, whereas the ultimate impact of the Department of Labor's test is on minimum wage and overtime requirements.
Kayla, so we've talked about the classification standards as they apply to the FLSA and various other federal contexts. Are there any state classification issues that employers should be aware of?
There are so many state and local classification issues that employers should be aware of. You know, in preparing for this presentation, I did a bunch of fun Google searches for things like independent contractor classification rules by state to try to find some, like a master list. And the ones I found were either incomplete or they were not up to date, or they didn't take into account all of the different ways that classification can interact with various state and local laws. And so on this slide, we highlight, we're looking at state wage and hour laws, which obviously not all states have their own separate wage and hour laws apart from the FLSA, but many of them do. And they have their own classification tests in connection with those laws. You have employer designation for the context of paying out unemployment insurance to that state's unemployment insurance fund. You have laws concerning workers' compensation and who's responsible for making sure that workers' compensation is kept. If it's a employer, you're expected to provide coverage for your employers, but not necessarily your independent contractor. So that can get a little messy. You also have, just general sort of employer liability issues. And dependent on the state and even the city that the worker is working within, the rule can be different from state to state. So you could have, for example, an ABC test for a state in the context of unemployment insurance. But that same state, for the purpose of their wage and hour, might follow controlled direction or their common law. New York, for example, they follow ABC tests for construction industry, I believe in the context of unemployment insurance and wage. It might be workers' compensation, not unemployment insurance. I can't recall off the top of my head, but it's construction industry only. For all other industries, they do common law. So you have to be really careful about classification in the context of all of these different potential areas. And I think that there's a lot of room for error here, unfortunately. There's nothing that's bright line. And these rules are also so fact-specific and can get employers into a host of trouble. And up here, we listed the ABC test. For those of y'all that don't know, California was sort of, I don't want to say on the forefront of this, but they did codify it. And there's a presumption of employment versus it being an independent contractor relationship. And the employer has the burden of demonstrating that certain conditions are met, and you have variation. And if those conditions are met, then the worker is an independent contractor. And you have numerous states and even cities such as Tucson, Arizona, for example, adopting this ABC test, which is very broad.
Kayla, we're getting a question from the audience here. Wondering if the 2024 new rule has any impact on company practices in states that utilize the ABC test.
I believe the answer is no. States have authority to promulgate the ABC test, which is more restrictive than the Department of Labor's test. But do you think differently?
No, I mean, this is something we talked about quite a bit leading up to the Department of Labor rule taking effect in March, because now there's layers of different tests defining whether one worker is classified, appropriately classified as an employee or an independent. So how are we going to work through these different layers of rules? And what we found, you have to look at the different factors for a single worker. But in a lot of instances, like Kayla said, an ABC test, let's take California. That's the example we always talk about. Looking at a worker under California's ABC test, that test is probably, and in most instances, more likely to define someone as an employee as compared to the Department of Labor's 2024 test. So the 2024 Department of Labor test would not supersede the California's ABC test to the extent that the ABC test makes it more likely that a worker should be classified as an employee.
Another test is called ANC of the ABC, also known as Control and Direction. Colorado has that. There's also a presumption of employment status unless it is shown that the individual is free from control and direction in the performance of services, both under contract and in fact, so what's papered and also what's happening in reality, and that the individual is customarily engaged in their own independent business related to the work performed. So example, if you're talking about a landscaper, that they are providing landscape services for other businesses in the community. And then of course, the common law is still prevalent, and this list is not in any way complete, by the way. We were trying to include states from clients and in-house counsel where we knew who we knew would be attending today.
So we've got quite a web or layers, as Luke put it, of various regulations, both at the federal and state level. Let's talk about some possible consequences for misclassification.
Absolutely. The big one is wage theft claims and claims for unpaid overtime, penalties associated with anything in connection with unpaid wages. You have attorney's fees, all kinds of ways that workers or an agency can come after a business who has not been properly classifying their workers as employees. You also have with the proliferation of state mandated paid sick leave initiatives during the COVID-19 epidemic. You have employees who are now entitled to paid sick leave. And if for whatever reason you have accidentally or intentionally misclassified a worker and not provided that sick leave, that potentially opens the business up to claims for unpaid sick leave, all kinds of fun things around that. You also might be calculating your workforce to be under 15 workers, or excuse me, under 15 employees or under 50 employees based on a split where the majority of your workers are classified as independent contractors. If there's misclassification going on and that number is legally much higher, all of a sudden, you are a business who should have been complying with the ADA or the FMLA. So those are just a handful of ways that businesses can get themselves into hot water very quickly.
We've also seen some unique state law issues pop up. And I wanted to highlight these because I know that folks on the webinar now have more dispersed workforces spread across states where they're not headquartered and they might not be as familiar with all of the technical legal requirements in each state. But just for example, New Jersey now has a law that requires statutory severance. A new concept, right? And I was surprised when this law passed and took effect. Employers are required to pay all terminated employees 1 week of pay for each year of service and provide additional payment if they give less than 90 days notice prior to termination. So if you have an independent contractor who is based in New Jersey and they allege they've been misclassified, part of the claim you will receive would be a demand for this statutory severance payment, which again, totally new concept. Go across the country to California. You keep landing there. California's Private Attorney General Act claims last summer in July 2023, the California Supreme Court ruled that PAGA, Private Attorney General Act, PAGA plaintiffs do not lack standing to pursue representative claims, even if the individual has signed an arbitration agreement. So let that sink in. You have arbitration agreements signed with all of your employees. You think any employment disputes that you're able to have adjudicated in the arbitration forum will be. The PAGA Act says that an individual can bring that claim in court. And furthermore, the ruling also permitted collective PAGA actions to survive. So an individual can assert a claim on behalf of themselves and on behalf of all similarly situated employees. And so this ruling was about halfway through the year last year. In 2023, there were more than 5,000 collective PAGA employment actions. The plaintiff's bar is flocking to this opportunity. And those are just two examples of other state law consequences of potential consequences of misclassification.
Like another fascinating, or I think it's fascinating, enforcement trend that's happening is at the municipal level. And we see that right here in the city of Denver's auditor's office. And their investigations and priority at looking at gig companies that have workers in the city of Denver. And that is something that's really ramped up in the past, I want to say 6 months. The city of Denver has levied very large penalties and fines against gig companies for alleged misclassification, and also forming the base, and also ordered the payment of wages and overtime and all of that fun stuff. But with that, the auditor's office has gone beyond the city of Denver's Wage Theft Act and also said, okay, we're going to try to enforce other state and federal laws here, including not paying Colorado as sick leave. So very interesting things going on, lots of active enforcement at all levels of government right now. And especially, I think, with the proliferation of gig companies, we're seeing a lot of this sort of thing and a response reaction to that. But trickles down to non-gig companies.
Yeah, that's enough of the scary stuff. I think I'm not in.
One last area that I want to mention, Lou. As everyone knows, the old adage, the only two things that are certain in life are death and taxes. Of course, there are tax implications to misclassification as well. And those tax implications are actually twofold. One, because if an employee or a worker, is misclassified as an independent contractor when they shouldn't have been classified as an employee, the employer's share of taxes are not paid because the employer wouldn't have been remitting taxes on the employee's behalf for an independent contractor. And also the employee's share of taxes are not withheld because the independent contractor doesn't have any withholdings coming out of their paycheck. They're paid pursuant to a 1099. So if a business has misclassified a worker as an independent contractor without a reasonable basis, it could be held liable for employment taxes for that worker. Now, the good news is for those workers who are misclassified, the IRS provides some tools to help true up and get back on the right track with respect to withholding and payment of taxes. The IRS has the form 8919 that can be a helpful tool for employees to help figure out or report their share of uncollected Social Security and Medicare taxes. Unfortunately, for the employer side, truing up those unremitted taxes can be a lot more challenging and complicated to figure out how much FICA, how much FUTA was owed. I guess the one little piece of good news that we can share there is that Brownstein has an excellent employment benefits and executive comp team that can very, very effectively help an employer figure out what taxes are owed in the event of a misclassification.
We promised earlier that we were going to talk about restrictive covenants briefly as it relates to independent contractors, because you know it's on most people's mind right now. If there's a question of whether or not the FTC's final rule, once effective, and I really wish I would have wrote if effective on the slide versus once, likely does apply to independent contractors. And the FTC commissioner said so in the final rule that it's meant to apply. State laws also likely apply in almost every circumstances, in my opinion, to independent contractors, regardless of whether or not how the statute's written. And I've seen a lot of statutes that I would like to rewrite at the state level in connection with restrictive covenant agreements. And by the way, when we're talking about restrictive covenant agreements, we're talking about non-competes, non-solicits, non-disclosure agreements, non-recruitment, non-hiring. Restrictive covenant is just, it's a broad term to encompass all of them. So there are a lot of state statutes that refer to things like employer shall not XYZ with employee, or with employer shall not XYZ with worker. And also using the words employee and worker interchangeably, I think if a business were to try to, or an individual were to try to challenge those statutes on the basis that they do not apply to independent contractor, I doubt they would be successful. Although if I was I would maybe make that argument. But I think from a compliance standpoint, the assumption should be that the restrictive covenant laws of various states do apply to independent contractors, and the fact that they've been classified that way as opposed to a W-2 employee does not matter. Let's talk about something else in connection with non-competes and restrictive covenants. Does the existence of a non-compete or other type of restrictive covenant that you've asked your independent contractor to sign, does that automatically actually make them an employee as opposed to an independent contractor? Thoughts?
Really good question. And you can think of a lot of different types of examples where a company would want to impose some sort of a restriction on what an independent contractor does while it's performing services for the company, and maybe even afterward. So if you have a contractor come in and they're given access to sensitive information of the company, trade secret level information, you'd certainly want to have a broad confidentiality provision in place. You may want to try to identify competitors who they will not be allowed to work with during the time the contract is in place. And I'm thinking, if I'm working for a company, if I have my ultimate set of goals checked, and for after the period of when the contract is in place, I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all answer to that question, where if there's, let's say, a non-compete restriction in an independent contractor agreement, it automatically means that person has been misclassified. I think it would certainly be a strong factor to take into account, and it makes it look more likely that person is an employee. They're no longer independent. We typically think of independent contractors who are people marketing their services to the free market. And that's part of what makes them independent from the business. So I think it's a strong factor to take into account, but I don't think it results in an automatic finding of misclassification. But if you have a relationship with a contractor and there are some real concerns about that person being able to take confidential information and potentially use it to the detriment of the company, I think there are ways to protect that contractually. But you need to be careful in doing so, and whatever restrictions you do put in place should be clearly tied to that specific role. So whereas for employment agreements, we have set stock restrictive covenants, or we used to, now we're rethinking it after the FTC's rule. For independent contractors, I don't think one stock set of restrictive covenants will work. You should give more thought to the nature of the work that's being performed and the relationship you have with that particular contractor.
I think that's right, Luke. And I know yesterday we were talking about this idea. Okay, what if you just asked an independent contractor to enter into a non-compete during the term of their contractor agreement? Would that be more or less likely to make them an employee as opposed to an independent contractor? And I think that after giving it some thought, I think that it is possible if you have somebody who's working, you know, a very short term type of contract, maybe a month, 2 months, 3 months, where their only work, and that's their business model, where they go in, they assist a company with consulting, for example, and they're only working for they have one client for that period of time, and then they go on to another client. I think that you could potentially make an argument that a non-compete is valid and enforceable under certain conditions, obviously, like satisfying whatever that state's rules are, and the FTC's to the extent, and if it ever becomes effective. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the real move here, and I've actually seen independent contractor agreements with non-compete agreements, which is why we're talking about this. But I think the move here is to shift away from just flat non-competes and really focus on the non-disclosure agreement language, on the non-solicitation, on the no recruitment, to the extent the state you're in permits those kinds of agreements. So it's all very fact-specific, and that is what's so, I think, frustrating about classification questions is because there's no wrong or right answer. You just do your best, and you hope that you created enough of a record to demonstrate that you were acting in good faith, the extent that's even relevant, if there is ever any sort of challenge, judicial challenge to that, or investigation by an agency. I'm really curious to hear about your experience in the M&A sphere and classification.
It is an issue that comes up frequently in mergers and acquisitions. And just to start, the kind of 101 level, first look at, are we dealing with an asset deal in which assets of the company are being sold to a buyer, but there is no ongoing continuation of the seller entity. And for employees, that means that their employment with the current employer will come to an end. And oftentimes, then they are rehired by the buyer. In that instance, it's a natural point in time upon closing of the transaction to re-examine relationships that were previously in place. And if the buyer wants to continue to engage certain independent contractors, that's a clear point in time to re-examine their classification. It can be a bit more complicated in the equity context, where the buyer is purchasing equity of the seller company, and employment of the existing employees will continue and not be interrupted through the closing date. And potentially the contracts that are already in place with independent contractors will continue to be in effect as well. That closing date still marks a natural point in time that if there are questions about a particular relationship, re-examine it. If you think you need to reclassify, do it as soon as possible. If you, as the buyer, take quick action, you can limit your exposure on any potential misclassification issues. Now, how do these issues come up in the first place? They come up as part of the diligence process, right? The seller is looking through all of its practices, preparing its company to be sold to a potential buyer. One of the hot button employment issues that a seller always looks at are its independent contractor relationships. And because the tests that we've described are constantly changing, maybe they have classified a worker one way. At that point in time, test has changed, and now it's time to re-examine the nature of that relationship. And if you're the buyer, information about relationships with independent contractors is one of the key pieces of information that you will want to get related to employment of the company that you're potentially acquiring. And if it's unclear whether a worker has been classified appropriately, treated consistently, issued the correct paperwork, which primarily is 1099s, but also we want to look and see, do they have an independent contractor agreement in place that contains the standard language we look for, an acknowledgement by both sides that the person's an independent contractor, an agreement by the contractor that they're going to pay all taxes under the arrangement and that they're going to provide materials that they need to perform their services. If those things are missing, that is going to raise a red flag for the buyer. And it happens so frequently that that I thought it was worthwhile to talk about this a bit today. Misclassification can potentially impact a deal. Oftentimes, a seller will take a uniform approach to a group of employees. And that uniform approach may be to classify everyone in a particular role as an independent contractor. And if those roles are supporting a key part of the service, then that has the potential to become a real key part of the deal because those employees are important to the company that the buyer is purchasing. And if they have been misclassified, clearly there is potential liability attached to that, but there's also an issue with the workforce that's really supporting the company that's being purchased. So these can be significant issues both before closing, and then if there's cleanup or reclassification required post-closing, that's going to change the dynamic between the company and its workers. And quite honestly, some workers like being independent contractors, even if the law says that you should be treated as an employee. So we spent a lot of time thinking through how to navigate the potential reclassification in that scenario. Very quickly, actions that a buyer can take pre-closing, post-closing, perform an audit, reclassify where necessary, and then documentation is key. Document all relationships in light of the applicable rules at that time and also take into account states where workers are located. So if you have multiple folks spread across different states, even if they perform the same role, there may be differences in the agreements that you enter into with them.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I think my assumption is always, oh, everyone wants to be considered a W-2. But especially I found in the tech industry, a lot of tech workers really like holding on to that independent contractor title. Even if they've been working with the same company for 10 years, 40 hours a week, and are effectively an employee, they have a really hard time with letting go of that. And so there's a lot of strategizing about how you're going to communicate with this workforce post-closing. Okay, we want to keep you on. You are integral to the company, but you're also going to be a W-2 worker. The other thing that we see sometimes is workers just not, they like taking home that paycheck that doesn't have their taxes coming out because it looks a lot better than a paycheck where their taxes taken out. And we've seen in diligence interesting bonus structures where a bonus will be paid out to a W-2 worker as if they were a 1099 worker. So you have untaxed, very large bonus grants. And there is a lot of liability, tax liability specifically, in connection with that. And those types of practices, employment practices, can lead to killing a deal or completely restructuring it. because there's so much risk with purchasing a business with that kind of a tax liability on its book. If that's a practice that's been implemented for over a long period of time for a lot of employees.
Kayla, do you think that for workers, there's a misconception? Do you think there's certain misconceptions as to why they would rather be classified as independent contractors rather than employees? And in the context that Luke was talking about, where a business might have to reclassify workers that were previously classified as independent contractors, what can the employer do to help, I guess, educate their workforce as to why it might be beneficial to treat them as W-2s?
Well, I think that's tricky and goes hand in hand with our next slide, which is on reclassification of the workforce. Because when you're reclassifying your workforce or having these conversations, you want to tread very lightly to ever acknowledge that a mistake may have been made in the past. You want to be very forward thinking for the most part. So I think that's a very interesting question. I have to think about what my answer would be. Obviously, as an employer, as an employee, you have more, you can have more rights in certain states and cities in connection with paid and protected leaves. You get benefits or access to more or different benefits than you would if you're an independent contractor. But I mean, for some people, it's a sticking point, and they like the idea that of saying they're their own boss. And I think that that is a very fact-specific type of situation that HR professionals and managers have to work through with that worker to see if that worker can make the transition. Do you all have any other thoughts on that?
Not on the employee side. I think that's exactly right. On the employer side, as you were starting in it, talk through Kayla, there can be some very difficult issues that an employer needs to work through. I think the starting point is there's a new rule that has taken effect for federal wage and hour purposes. And we are looking at roles under the test in the new rule and as those roles are currently constituted. Every situation is different, and there may be a situation where you also need to look backward and potentially think about treating people retroactively as if they had been employees. But I think the starting point, as you said, is forward-looking. And how should people be classified now going forward? Getting the right documents in place, if that's an employment agreement, it's focused on the duties associated with their role at this point in time, and then do this test that we're examining the role under. And then having conversations with those workers about changing their status. There are a number of implications, paid leave, benefits, taxes, a lot of issues to work through that can be viewed as both positive and negative. And those are not easy conversations to have, but I think the starting point is the new rule that's recently taken effect.
Absolutely. I think that it's a good jumping off point too. If you think that you may have had issues for a while, you can use the new rule as an excuse almost.
Well, yeah, it's a departure from what was being done the past 3 years, certainly. Yep.
There was something else we noted. There is a form that you can file with the IRS for to determine whether a worker status be for tax liability purposes only. The three of us have, I don't think any of us have ever actually done that.
I haven't used it.
No. I have not used it, but it does exist. We wanted to highlight that. And some other keys when you're reclassifying, I think that it's really important to, I think you mentioned this before, about documenting the new relationships.
Yeah.
And the reasons that support that conclusion. And as a lot of the folks know on this call, it's very difficult to have somebody release a wage claim. But there, there is certain language you can use to try to do as best as you can in connection with that. And I like to do that when we're reclassifying to the extent I'm allowed. And also, drafting really good independent contractor agreements. I have a few clients where I've handed them very robust, long independent contractor agreements, and they say, no independent contractor is going to sign this. They're a marketing professional. Well, yeah, they're a marketing professional that you're paying almost six figures to. And you want to make sure that you're covered and everything is very cleared about the scope of the relationship. But and also you want to have a really good non-disclosure agreement too, to the extent that that state permits them. So, and you know, not solicit.
We have one question from the audience. We have 1 minute left. The question is, does a cooling off period matter to draw a clear line if you have an employee who's leaving their employment role and will become an independent contractor for the same company? So should there be some period of time where they sit out, they're not working for the company in any capacity?
I don't think so. I think it's more of just making sure you documented everything really well in terms of this is what the old relationship looks like, and now this is what the new relationship looks like, and form and in fact in function, basically. And if you've already made that transition, it's not too late to paper that. Just paper it as soon as you can. But I mean,
my first question is, what is the difference between their role as an employee and their role as an independent contractor? And there should be a very clear explanation for that. And if you have a good answer and there's a clear difference between what they were doing, maybe that role is no longer required, but they're going to continue to assist on a specific project that they can work on or have a very set function. I've seen plenty of those conversions happen, and I don't think there's a requirement for a sit out. They're not under employment, under current employment.
I mean, there could be some sort of weird law that exists in some city that we don't know about, but I would highly doubt that.
Yeah.
So anyways, we had so much fun talking about independent contractor classification with you all during your lunch hour, and we're just so honored that you all tuned in.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brownstein Hyatt Farber Shrek podcast series. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Visit bhfs.com for more information.